C from Addison, Texas.
Yes. Yes. Nicely done. I did not even ask him to say that part. Must be true. My name is Ellen Cassidy, and I'm an enthusiastic, boundlessly grateful Al-Anon.
Hi, Ellen.
Hi. I am so grateful to be with you. I am so happy to be here. Thank the committee for getting me here. Thank the committee for Sherry. She is like a world-class hostess. Ah! She brought me chocolate and Coke to talk with. Now, if I did that, there would be no speaking. I would be over here indulging in that sin, but I'm not going to do that yet. Anyway, I am so, so grateful to be here, and I am always so grateful to be included in a weekend of AA. I am grateful to be able to sit and hear wonderful AA speakers and to know them. Like Rick said, generally when we go on these weekends, we're the only one. And not always are AA speakers as thrilled to have us there as the committee is, and vice versa sometimes. So there are those, though. Most AA speakers have been very generous with me, and I particularly appreciate Mari and I have been together before. We've almost gotten in trouble before, but we're so recovered now that won't happen, I'm pretty sure. And I'm so glad you're here. Thank you. I introduced myself as an Al-Anon. I always want to explain that. That's not good news. Explaining things is how I got to Al-Anon. I always thought that if I could get you to listen long enough, then you'd understand. Then you'd see why my way really was the best way, and you'd agree to do it, and we'd all be happy after that. What's happened to me in recovery is God says, you know that thing you thought was a defect? I can use it as an asset. I can use it. Ellen, you explained so well. I have little groups of people all over who just need some explanation. How about you go explain to them? And today is your day in the barrel. Al-Anon isn't what I wanted to be when I grew up. I didn't know there was such a thing as Al-Anon until I got here. What I wanted to be when I grew up, I think from my first breath and maybe before that, was I wanted to be somebody's wife and somebody's mother. And I was going to be the best wife he ever had, and I was going to be the best mother those children ever had. I'd been in Al-Anon a number of years before I realized that I had never in my whole life wanted to be me. I always wanted to be the best in somebody else's eyes, and you can't do it. It's a non-happening thing because they can't fill this hole inside of me. What I ended up being was somebody's judge and somebody's juror and somebody's executioner, and none of us were happy. When I got to Al-Anon, I decided pretty quickly that I really didn't want to be an Al-Anon. What I really wanted to be was alcoholic. And I had a number of reasons for that. Number one, it appeared to me that alcoholic women had more fun than we did. And apparently my husband preferred them. So I am not taking inventory, I am just reporting. I decided I wanted to be alcoholic. Now, before I tell you this next part, I need to tell you that alcoholic women saved my life. I did not come to Al-Anon surrendered. I'm not sure that many of us do. I came to Al-Anon looking for one more thing that might work, one more thing I hadn't tried, so I could get him to be the way I thought he needed to be so we/I could be okay. But what happens is life continues to offer you chances to surrender. If you don't know whether or not you've surrendered, you have not. It will leave no doubt in your mind when that happens. And just because it's happened to you once, you are not scot-free because you're still living. And then life will offer you another opportunity and another and another and another. And if you've missed it, it's okay. There's another one coming. Now, the next one may be a little louder, probably more painful, more people will watch you fall down, but it's coming. And if you miss that one, another one right behind that one. So my chance came about 3 years into to Al-Anon. And when I fell into that big black hole, I didn't have to explain it to the alcoholic women. They understood. It was an alcoholic woman who said to me, "Sweetheart, those Al-Anons mean well, but they really have no idea." She said, what you need is 448 through 452, which is third edition for those of you who are just starting at fourth edition. That's third edition, big book. She said, you need it every day till you don't need it anymore. And they're the pages on acceptance, and I still need those pages every day. So I will tell you that alcoholic women saved my life. And then I will tell you that the day I decided to be alcoholic, I didn't want to drink to be alcoholic. I had a lot of reasons for that, too. Number one, I come from a family of heavy drinkers. I come from a family that acted as if there was something the matter with people who didn't drink. You should stay away from them, Ellen. They're probably fanatics. Some of them might even be Baptists. You know, I know today that what I have is selective hearing. I hear what I want to hear. And I'm, you know, it may be what you said. It may have nothing to do with what you said, but it's what I anticipated hearing, and so that's what I heard. Today I know my family didn't say that, but that's what I thought they said. Anyway, I grew up in a family where drinking was the accepted thing. And even though when I was new to Al-Anon, they told me I had to quit diagnosing people as alcoholic, I'm really very good at it. It is one of my better assets. If I love you, it is the kiss of death. They said I had to quit diagnosing people as alcoholic, but they said, sweetheart, if they walk like a duck and they swim like a duck and they quack like a duck, you need to treat them like ducks, you know. And apparently quacking is like mother's milk to me. If I don't hear quacking, I will hunt it up, you know, until I've got a sufficient amount of quacking to make me okay. I couldn't diagnose people as alcoholic, but there was a lot of quacking in my family, just lots of quacking. I married a good number of quackers, and I worked for a man who quacked in his office for 13 years, and I raised a quacker. But they said you can't, you know, I can't tell you that there was alcoholism in my family, except by my own behavior. That will tell you that there was alcoholism in my family. So they said, well, you can't diagnose these people as alcoholic in your family. And I'm thinking, yeah, but I've heard these stories about the lines. You know, there's this line someplace, and some people are born on one side of the line or the other side of the line, apparently. And if you drink enough, you get to the other side of the line. And I'm thinking, you know what, I have two drinks every night, and I really enjoy both of them, you know, both of them. Do I want a third one? No. One time I had a third one. And I think probably a fourth and fifth when it was New Year's Eve. And I was so sick the next day. And all of a sudden I have this flashback about what happened the night before. I believe we showed porn movies to my boss and his wife. Oh, did I ever do that again? No, I never did. So I don't believe I've crossed the line, but I'm afraid if I allowed myself to drink all I might drink, it might happen. And the stories I've heard is that most people that cross the line don't get to come in here, and I don't want to take that chance. So I didn't want to drink to be alcoholic. And actually, I needed to be alcoholic that afternoon, so I really didn't have time. So pretty much I came up with the same solution I always come up with in my diseasiness. In my diseasiness, I think if I change how it looks on the outside, it's going to change how I feel on the inside. Sometimes I have to change how you look. Sometimes I have to change how the relationship looks. Sometimes I do an ongoing thing to us, which is if only this would happen, then I'd feel okay, you know. And it's got to change how it looks, so I'll change how I feel. So all I had to do was look alcoholic that afternoon. I came into Al-Anon. My first meeting was November 7th of 1981, and I came in gorgeous North Dallas, and there is a look to North Dallas alcoholic women. That was the look I donned that afternoon. I had to borrow the clothes because I don't own any like that. And what it meant was I had to put on skin-tight jeans and stiletto heels. Well, I made a couple of discoveries in that little experiment. First off, I didn't like anything control me like those pants did. And number two, Al-Anons really are doomed to sensible shoes. We really are built for speed and not for looks. You know, if you love an alcoholic, you have got to be ready to go in a heartbeat, or you could lose him and kill yourself in the attempt. Well, the place I decided to do this little experiment was at Crested Butte, Colorado, with 600 of my closest friends. And there were that week there, four people who had between them 125 years of Al-Anon, and this was 20 plus years ago. That was a lot of Al-Anon. I got to not only hear their stories, I got to not only sit in meetings with them, I got not only to spend time one-on-one with them, but I got to watch their interaction with their families. And I finally knew what it was I wanted to be when I grew up. I want that freedom that's offered to me in step three, because that's what I saw in them. The freedom to be who it is God would have that, what God would have them be. And I left there so grateful that there's such a thing as Al-Anon to be. Now, when I got to Al-Anon, I didn't have very many strong opinions. I either had yours or the opposite of yours, depending on what I needed you to do. Today, I have very strong opinions. And one of my strong opinions is about people being called Al-Anon. If you want to watch the hair on my neck stand up, let me be in the room when some new drunk comes in the room and some annoying alcoholic says, "Oh, look, there's John, the new alcoholic, and there's Trudy, his little Al-Anon wife, twitching in behind him." And the only reason they're calling her Al-Anon is because she's twitching in behind John. We do tend to come with a twitch. I don't know if you'd notice that or not. She is not an Al-Anon. She's an alligator. Al-Anon is not a program for people who need it. The statistics are, for every alcoholic, there are 1 to 4 people profoundly affected. There are 10 to 42 people directly affected. This meeting could be 1 to 4 to 10 times bigger than the meeting tonight. It's not a happening thing. As difficult as I suspect it is to get into AA, I think it is harder to get into Al-Anon. It is darn near impossible to come in and ask for help when there's nothing the matter with you. I love that. The AAs always wait to see if the Al-Anons are going to laugh. They don't know that we know, really. We knew all that. There was nothing the matter with me when I got here. I had to stay here a while before the problem emerged. Al-Anon is not a program for people who want it. We get a lot of people come to our meetings as newcomers. Some of them are drawn in by the laughter, and some of them are repelled by the laughter. Alcoholism is not funny. It's a deadly disease. It kills the people who have it, and it kills the people who love them. If you hear us laughing about things this weekend that you don't think are funny, I want to invite you to keep coming back. You cannot laugh about something that hasn't been healed. But if it's been healed for one of us, it can be healed for all of us. Keep coming. Al-Anon is really only a program for people who are willing to work at it, because that's what it requires. It requires effort. Not necessarily consistent effort, but it requires ongoing effort. I came to Al-Anon because of the first part of the first step, my powerlessness over alcoholism. What has kept me in Al-Anon is the second part of the first step, the unmanageability of my own life, the unmanageability of my head, the unmanageability of my fears. That's what's kept me here. I'm not an Al-Anon because of those people in my life. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a 12-step recovery program that I practice like my life depends on it. I am convinced today of the fatal nature of my disease. I am an Al-Anon because I have a committed meeting that I go to every week like a doctor's appointment. If you want to find me, you come Monday night at 6:15 to the Addison Al-Anon family group meeting, and that's where I'll be. And when I walk in that room, they go, "Oh, Alan, there you are." Sometimes they just sit with their eyes, but they say. And it's one of the reasons I love these weekends. I just love these weekends. Tim was walking in with us last night, and I'm watching Tim see people that he hasn't seen in a long time. He'll go, and he actually, he could hear him take his breath in and go, "Oh," he was so excited to see these people. My room just happens to be over the fume area. Cigarettes and motorcycles right out there. It's okay, I love bikers. Love them, love them, love them. Big part of my story you won't hear today. But anyway, just know that I love those boys. Ah, be easier to make a list of the boys I don't love, but I love those boys. Anyway, I love being in that room because I hear them down there. The chatter level down there, people just so glad to see each other. Is, you know, this doesn't happen in a business world. People don't walk into the room and go, "Oh, I thought you were dead." You know, guys hugging guys, everybody's kissing everybody, you know. Oh, this is so fabulous. Anyway. I'm an Al-Anon because I have a sponsor who knows everything there is to know about me and apparently more. She treats me like Rick's sponsor treats him. When I tell her something, it seems like she loves me more when I'm done than she did when I started. I am an Al-Anon, and I am so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous that there is such a thing as Al-Anon to be. My mama diagnosed me when I was 17, and my mama diagnosed me as boy crazy. And the place my mama sent me to be safe was Lubbock, Texas. And the very first Al-Anon meeting in the entire state of Texas was held in Lubbock, because Lubbock is a dry area. I don't know if you know about dry areas, but dry areas is where they tell alcoholics they can't drink. And we all know that nothing makes them drink faster than tell them they can't. But if you're a girl on the hunt, and I was always on the hunt for him, you know, I was always looking for him. And if you're looking for him in a dry area, it's very easy to find him. They're all right outside the city limits. Took me 6 months to find him, but I found him. He was married to somebody else and had two kids and was 60 pounds overweight, but none of that seemed insurmountable to me. I personally have never liked the easy ones. You know, I don't like the ones who go, oh, you're so cute. Can I have a... No! Get away from me! I want those ones you have to fight for, you know? Those ones you have to earn. Those ones you have to make love you. My people. And then when you get them, you go, for about a week and a half, you know, and then it's like, huh. Well, this was a great challenge for me, and so, of course, I had to stick with it longer. And a year later, we had shed the wife, the two kids, and the 60 pounds, and I had my trophy, oh, lucky, lucky me. We were married 6 months when he hit me the first time. He was drunk when he hit me. He was drunk every time he hit me. I didn't grow up in a family where adults hit each other, so the reaction I had to that was not anything anybody taught me. I thought it up all by myself in this fabulous solution center I have between my ears. I've come to discover in Al-Anon that the problems in my life really aren't the problems in my life. The problems in my life are the solutions I come up with for what I perceive to be the problems in my life. Well, the very best thing I could think of to do was double dog dare him to do it again. Made perfect sense at the time. I'm a big sister with lots of little brothers, and I used to smack the snot out of them on a regular basis. And all you had to do was double dog dare them one more time with your orthopedic shoes on, and they backed off, you know. This one didn't back off. We lived like that for another 9 years because I'm a sticker. And I will make my bed and I will damn near die in it. I was a volunteer for that abuse for some length of time. At some place in that journey, I crossed the line and I went from the volunteer to the victim. I cannot tell you when it happened. I know as a result of inventories today how it happened. Every time he hit me, and I believed what he said, which was, if I hadn't done what I did, he wouldn't have to do what he did. Every time he hit me, and I believed what he said, which was, I deserved that. Every time he hit me, and I got up the next morning, and I looked in the mirror at a black eye or a split lip or a bloody nose, and I said to myself, it's not that bad. A piece of me left, and another piece, and another piece, and another piece, until 9 years later there was nobody left who could stand up and say, you can't treat me like that. I am a precious child of God's. The reason I left him was because somebody else came along who said, you don't have to live like that, and I love you. The magic words have been added. When I came to Al-Anon, I pretty much had one feeling. My observation is that most of us come to Al-Anon with one of two feelings. We either come in angry or we come in hurt. It's the same feeling. It's either whether we're sucking it in on us or blowing it out on you. I came in hurt, and my sponsor, I'd talk to my sponsor, and I'd tell her something, and she'd say, how do you feel? And I'd go, I don't know. She never bought that. She never, ever bought you don't know. She made me buy one of those magnetic things, you know, with the faces on it, with the feelings underneath them, and you had to match your face to that face, and then you knew how you feel, and I had to put it on the refrigerator. So I'm talking to her on the phone. How do you feel? I don't know. Go to the refrigerator. Go to the refrigerator. And then try to tell her what the feeling was that went with that. And one day, when I was fairly new in Al-Anon, I had another feeling besides hurt. And I was so thrilled, and I knew she would be thrilled. I could hardly wait to tell her. So I picked up the phone and called her, and I said, guess what? I have another feeling. She said, fabulous. What is it? I said, fear. Sucking that approval, you know. She said, oh, terrific. She said, what are you afraid of? I said, oh, do I need to know that? You know. She said, actually, it's very helpful if you know what you're afraid of. And you know, here's the deal. Fear is not a defect of character. Fear of fear is a defect of character. Fear is a very human emotion. But I'm afraid to be afraid. Because what happens when I get afraid is it takes over my body. It takes over my mind. Everything I do is colored by the fear. I am terrified to be afraid because I lose myself in the fear. And she said, what are you afraid of? And I said, I don't know. And she said what she said to me so many times, I'll stay on the phone while you figure it out. And she just let me talk and talk and talk and talk and talk until I heard myself say what I was afraid of. And what I finally was able to say to her is, I'm afraid he's going to leave me. That's it. She said, why are you afraid he's going to leave you? And I said, well, he said he was leaving. She said, when is he going? I said, well, he said he's going next Friday. And she said, honey, let me tell you something. The way you can tell whether or not an alcoholic is leaving you is if he's gone. Oh. She was the one who taught me to turn off the sound and look at the picture. That was one of my first tools. She said, turn off the sound and look at the picture. You can tell better by the picture what's actually going on than you can by the sound. So I said, that's the deal. I'm afraid he's going to leave me. And she said, so what happens if he leaves you? And I said, I'm afraid. I'm really, really afraid. Well, this sounds like it happened in a phone call, but it probably took about a week. Eventually, what I got to was, I'm afraid he's going to leave. I'm afraid he's going to leave me alone. I'm afraid to be alone. I am not enough. I am not strong enough. I am not wise enough. I don't have enough money. There isn't enough love. There was never enough for me. I hear alcoholics say that sometimes, that what they always wanted was more, of just more. Well, that's me. I had to have more because I wasn't enough. I wanted more and more and more. So I was afraid he was going to leave me all alone. And she said, and what happens if he leaves you all alone? And the fear was there. If he leaves me all alone, I'm not enough and I can't take care of myself. And if I can't take care of myself, I'll die. Now, that's a little kid fear. It makes no adult sense, but that's how it felt. I recognized in the last few years that there was another fear underneath that. He's going to leave me alone. I'm not enough. I can't take care of myself. I'll die, and there is no God. It became life and death to me that he stay, that I not be alone. So when somebody said, I love you, to me, what I heard was, I will stay with you. I will take care of you. I will not leave you. So here comes a guy who says, you don't have to live like that, which I'd heard plenty of times. But this one said, and I love you. All righty then. You would have loved him. Oh, I would have loved him. He was great. And I knew what I'd done wrong the first time, and I had an idea of what I was going to do right this time. You know, this one was the right age, right coloring, right family, right job, right education, right money, everything. He was just perfect. Well, there was this one tiny little flaw. He didn't come home nights. But I'm thinking, you know, a couple of home-cooked meals and a little, you know, and I got him. Well, that was pretty much the way I used to mark my territory, you know. Back when I cared, you know, back before menopause. Now, poof, I don't care. Anyway. Who cares? Chocolate is good. Anyway. Took me a year, but I'm like the Mounties. I always get my man. And I had him, oh, lucky, lucky me. And we rocked on, you know, just having this great, everything's going well. He's coming home every night, so I'm pretty sure I'm doing everything right, because it is all about me, you know. And if I'm doing it right, my world is working. If my world is not working, it's because I'm not doing something right. I am in control. Well, you know, the night came, he didn't come home. The boy was a bar drinker. I now realize there's a whole subset of alcoholics that I knew nothing about. He was a bar drinker. Night came, he didn't come home. I lay on the floor of the bathroom and I cried because I was pretty sure he'd seen the 2 pounds I gained, and that's why he didn't love me anymore, and that's why he wasn't coming home. And then I decided, stupid me, this morning when he said, "What's for dinner?" I said, "Roast beef." I should have said pork chops. Everybody knows pork chops are his favorite things. And I made myself a promise that from now on, whenever he asks what's for dinner, I'm always going to say pork chops, and then he'll always come home. And then I decided what I really needed to do was I need to go sit on the sofa and wait. Now, if you were in training for Al-Anon, you must pass graduate waiting. And the way that you know you're in graduate waiting is if when you are waiting, you can do nothing else. I couldn't talk on the phone, I couldn't read a book, I couldn't watch TV, I couldn't cook a meal, couldn't wash the clothes. The kids would come up and they'd go, "Mom," and I'd go, "I can't talk to you, I'm waiting." And that's because while I was waiting, I was listening. I was listening for the sound of those tires. There are 44 bazillion other tires on the planet. Don't care about them. Only care about those tires. I have a physical, spiritual, emotional reaction to the sound of those tires. It's not unlike what I've heard alcoholics say a drink did for them. I would hear those tires and I'd go, "Ah, it's all going to be okay now. He's home now." Now, my next thought may be, "I'm killing him when he walks through the door, but at least he will die in his own bed." And it was always preferable to be a widow than a divorcee, you know. And, of course, he came home. I recognize now that 99 times out of 100, they come home. It might be that day or the next week or 3 years later, but they come home, you know. And I met him at the door like a 3-year-old who's been crying all afternoon, and you've said, "Stop it." I was at that place, you know, with the big old swollen eyes and the snot slinging everywhere, you know. And you think about that, and you think, no wonder he drank, you know. If that's waiting for me at home, I'll just, give me another. You know, I'm not going now. And I asked the second stupidest question we ever asked. The stupidest, of course, is, "Have you been drinking?" The second stupidest is, "Where have you been?" And he said to me, he said, "Jesus, God, you certainly worked yourself up into a state. You knew where I was." Well, the truth of the matter is, I knew where he was. He only went 3 places. He was at home, at work, or in the trap room drinking. My mind had already decided where he was. And it's what my mind does in those kind of situations. My mind, left to its own devices while I'm waiting, had already created the whole entire scenario. And what my mind decided was that he was driving his car out in the country someplace, I don't know where, I don't know, I was just driving out there. And all of a sudden, for some reason, I don't know why, the car blew up. And it blew him in this ditch by the side of the road. And people are going by, but they can't see him because he's in the ditch. And he's bleeding and he's dying, but he's not quite dead. And with his dying breath, he's calling me. And he's saying, "Ellen, Ellen, I love you." And now wild animals are coming and stewing off body parts and throwing them in the forest, and it'll be 7 years before we can identify the body. Well, I called that love. I thought if you loved him enough to worry that much, it was love, you know? I have come to understand that that's not love, that's obsession. And the way you know it's obsession is if in your mind somebody dies. If you can take it all the way to death, it's obsession. You know what obsession is? It's all-out warfare on powerlessness. The more powerless I feel, the more obsessed I'm going to get. I might get obsessed about the thing I'm powerless over, and I might pick out something else altogether. I'm an equal opportunity obsessor. I can do it about your drinking. I can do it about your job. I can do it about my children. I can do it about your children. I can do it about my weight. I can do it about your weight. I can do it about money. I can do it about shopping. I can do it about anything. Today I know when that squirrel cage thinking starts in my head, there's some place in my life I'm powerless. And for whatever reason, I have not been willing or able to look at that. It's an alarm for me today. It is not a place I get lost anymore. But when he said to me, "You knew where I was," what happened was I have the ability to hold opposing thoughts in my head and they never touch. One thought was, "He loves me more than anything in the world." And my life hung on that one. And the other one is, "He's in the trap room drinking." But if this one is true, this one cannot be true. And in my diseasiness, I would rather wish him dead than know the truth. And that's what I did. And he said,
yes, I think you're about as crazy as your mother.
Big one, Elizabeth. And he said, I don't know why I stay married to you. And I said,
I'm so sorry.
Now, what's the matter with this picture? He's 3 hours late and drunk, and I'm the one standing at the door apologizing. I have an addiction to mind-altering men. Actually, I've discovered it's not limited to men. Anybody can mess with my mind. They don't even have to want to. They don't even have to be present. I can do it for them all by myself. Anyway, we rocked on for a while like that, and, you know, it's alcoholism. It's active alcoholism. Stuff doesn't get better in active alcoholism. It gets worse. One day I got a call at school from a gal, and she was an angry lady, and I didn't like angry people. They reminded me of alcoholics. I thought it was because I didn't know what they were going to do next. I always need to know what you're going to do next. I say it so I can be prepared. What I mean is so I can be in control. I think if an Al-Anon had written the big book, it would have said lack of control. That was my dilemma. I don't know that it isn't the same thing. Anyway, this lady called, and she wasn't angry. She was crying. Now, if you want to watch all the alarms go off for an alligator like I was, put me in the room with somebody crying. The primary alligator illusion is when you're okay, then I'll be okay. The trick is you have to be okay in my eyes, not in yours. In my eyes. You have to be the way I think you need to be, and then I'll be okay. And in my diseasiness, I will lie and I will cheat and I will steal. I will go places I don't want to go with people I don't want to be with. I won't eat when I'm hungry and I will eat when I'm not. I'll stay up when I'm tired and won't go to bed when I am. I'll sit up all night in the hospital with your sick mother when I don't like hospitals and I certainly don't like your mother. But I'll do it. And it looks very loving and kind on the outside, and it's the most self-centered behavior on the planet. I don't do it because I care. I do it because I need a reaction back from you. You need to do something so I'll be okay. And if you don't do it, I just do my behavior harder. Now, this lady is on the phone crying. You know, we have a deal in my Al-Anon group that I just feel moved to tell you about in my limited time. We have four tables all together, and we sit around the tables and around the walls, and we must have 7 boxes of Kleenexes on those tables. Somebody cries at every Al-Anon meeting. It just happens. Sometimes they cry out of pain, sometimes they cry out of relief, but people cry at Al-Anon meetings. When somebody cries at our room, we do not shove the Kleenex at them. It's a very subtle way of saying, I bet those tears are bothering you because they're bothering me. Dry them up. My sponsor told me one time that maybe the best thing we do for each other in Al-Anon is we attend each other's pain. We sit with each other when we hurt without saying things like, you need to get a better attitude and then you can come back to another meeting. Or wipe that look off your face, Missy, and you can sit down here next to me. It's not what we do. When somebody in our meeting cries and has a hard time, we do not put our arms around them and tell them everything's going to be okay. Because I can't make you that promise. The book says that when I get up here, I'm supposed to tell you what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm like today, not what it used to be like and what happened and what it's like today. There are plenty of times today when it still sucks. What's different today is my reaction to it, my response to it. So when somebody in our meeting is having a hard time, we sit with them and we tell them, we bet somebody in this room has had the same experience you have. Let us help you. Whatever it is you have to do, you do not have to do it alone. So anyway, this lady called and she's crying and I'm deep in my disease, and she says, my husband is in a 12-step recovery program, and as part of his recovery, pay the school back all the money we owe him, but it's going to take us a while. I just wanted you to know that we're going to try. And I said, I understand. My husband drinks too much too. I tell you, his drinking was not the problem. His not coming home was the problem. But I thought that that was about me. Of course I did. If I was a better wife, if the kids were better, if the house was cleaner, if I moved the TV 6 inches this way or 6 inches that way, I never could figure out which. But if it was all just perfect, then he'd come home. I wasn't going to tell her that. What I didn't know was talking to somebody new in the program, and we're deadly when we're new. We got a lot of answers. Don't know what the questions are, but we got a lot of answers. Al-Anon is often accused of doing the Al-Anon waltz. They say we do 1, 2, 12, 1, 2, 12, 1, 2, 12. I know what the problem is, and I've got the answer. Let me tell you about it. All those other steps, just filler. Filler in there, mostly for him, not for me. The AA 12 and 12 says step 6 is what separates from the men from the boys. I don't know what it is about that. Every time I think about that, I see sheep and goats. I don't know why, but it's men from boys. Al-Anon, it really is step 3. It really is step 3 where we fall off. We tell people if you do step 3, your life's going to change. And people go, you know, the ones you say that to will go, oh, wait a minute. Wait just a minute. There's been a little miscommunication. Did you think I wanted my life to change? Oh, no. We sing the Al-Anon chorus, you know. It's not that bad. I just wanted his life to change. My friend Bob B., who lives not far from you, he told me one time, he said, we're like people in a lake of liquid manure. It comes up to about here. It's not pleasant, but it's ours. And we've been there, you know, while it's been building. And so it's really nothing surprising about it. It's warm. We're used to it, you know. People come by in a boat and they say, you know what? You don't have to live like that. We can show you a way out. And we go, oh, no, that's okay. It's not that bad. I just want you to keep that guy over there from making waves. See, the part I don't like about that is it's pretty clear that the only thing they can kick up is my stuff. You know, that's all they can kick up. I told my sponsor one time, he was being so mean to me. I said, he's pushing all my buttons. She said, what are you doing with buttons? 4 and 5, 6 and 7 are the process of button removal, you know. So anyway, eventually she ended up dragging me into Al-Anon. She accompanied me to my first 6 meetings because she had the distinct impression I would not go by myself, and she took me. I landed in a nest of winners. They say you should stick to the winners. The problem is they don't have name tags on, except on weekends like this. I really believe that the winners are the ones who want more than the first miracle. The winners are the ones who want more than just to survive this deadly disease. I believe that the winners who are the ones who want everything these God-given programs can give us, which is nothing short of maybe heaven. I don't know. I don't come here because of how sick I am. I come here now because there's no limit to how ill I can be if I will come here with you. I landed in a nest of folks where I thought the first step in the program was get in the car. Because they would say, so-and-so is doing the steps across town, we're going to go over there, we're going to drive by and get you, get in the car. They didn't say, do you want to go, do you have time, can someone watch the kids? They said, get in the car. So I'd get in the car and I'd go. And we rocked on like that for a while, and then things got worse at my house. That's what happens in the disease of alcoholism, things got worse. I discovered he was having an affair. Now, here's the insanity. I knew he did drugs. I knew he gambled. I knew he drank. I knew he was coming home 7-8 times a month. But I always thought he was faithful. Well! Posing thoughts. What that made me deal with was the truth of why I came to Al-Anon. I would have told you that I came to Al-Anon because of my husband's unacceptable behavior. The fact of the matter is I was in Al-Anon because of my own unacceptable behavior. I was married to the man of my dreams and I was having an affair. It wasn't my first affair. Wasn't my last either, but it was real close. We have to go for progress, not perfection. Anyway. You know, Al-Anon has allowed me to close so many of those circles in my life where I get to see what it's like on both ends of that deal. So, shortly thereafter, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I was 38 years old. I was too young. There's no history of it in my family. They gave me a 60-40 chance of living another 5 years. And, I've hung my life on a couple of lines out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of them is in those pages on acceptance that says nothing but nothing happens by mistake in God's world. And the other one is the last column of the 4-step inventory that basically says, and what was your part? What did you contribute to this? What was your, what have you done in this thing? And, you know, it's the first time I recognized that there are not places in my life where I've been just a victim. Not since I've been grown up, anyway. There are not places in my life where I've been a victim. I've had something to do in everything. It's a very powerful idea that I could look at my part in all those things and maybe, just maybe, be free of the anger and the guilt and the shame from those things. I wanted to know what my part was in cancer. And I got in a step study and I did an inventory. And what I came up with was long process. What I came up with was there were studies back then that said that cancer was a stress-related disease. And I was blessed with doctors who didn't tell me why I had cancer. I came to understand that cancer is prevalent in alcoholic homes. Sitting in my meeting last week with 30 people in the room, there were 6 of us in there who had had breast cancer. That's a big percentage of people, and more than the average. And what I came up with as a result of doing the steps was that the cancer I had was a stress-caused disease. For the umpteenth time, I said it for the first time, I meant it. If you can't stop drinking, you can't stay here. And he left. But my life depended on it, finally. And finally, because you had treated me like my life was valuable, I had the sense that my life was valuable. Step 3 says restore. Restore is what you do to something of value. It doesn't say drag around behind the truck and beat it up till it doesn't look like anything it did before, you know. It says restore. And if you ask him why he left, he would have told you it's that crazy daughter of mine that anyone who had to live with that little wench would drink to. Well, a couple of years later, they called from the school and they said there's something the matter with your daughter. Duh. To give you an idea, she came home one Saturday morning, should have come home Friday night, didn't come home till Saturday morning. Do you see the pattern in my life? They don't come home. She came home, I'd been frantic, this is long before cell phones, didn't know where she was, dead or alive. Al-Anon had told me over and over again that bad news is perfectly capable of making the entire journey to you, you don't have to go hunt it down, so I was just waiting. Of course, I'm waiting for the bad news, is what I'm waiting. And she came in, and she was, oh, Mom, she said, we were driving around last night, we were minding our own business, we were out on the freeway, and this car came from out of nowhere. And they tried to slam us off the road. It was so scary. Mom was really, really scary. And the police came and they said, it wasn't our fault, Mom. Really, it wasn't our fault. And I'm like, oh my God, is everybody okay? Yeah, Mom, we're all fine, really. I'm just kind of tired. I think I'll go to my room. And I'm in the living room with a, you know, because I've picked it all up from her. School calls, there's something the matter with your daughter. Duh. They said, we're going to send her to an evaluation center to a treatment center for evaluation. Really? 2 days later, the guy from the treatment center calls, Ms. Davis, hate to tell you this, we do believe your daughter's alcoholic. And I said, yes! And he said, we've not had a lot of mothers react like that. And I said, oh, I'm so excited she's alcoholic. Oh, I thought she was crazy, Al-Anon disease. No sign she'll ever get any help for that. But alcoholism, yes! I can. She was 17, I could make her do stuff, you know. Had a lot of pent-up frustration. So I took her to a treatment center that would force-feed the steps into her. It was the only thing I knew that might work. This is the place that I work to get to this place when I tell my story, because I just cannot say these words enough. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, alcoholics, that you do what you do for the reason you do it. Thank you for not seeking some kind of success rate like Shikshadel, you know, or but you do what you do for the reason you do. The statistics are that for the young people who come in today, 80% of them have to go back out because they're not done. And my daughter was one of those 80%. She stayed sober about a year and a half. And she went back out, and it was worse when she went out. When she went back, it was much worse. She came back into Alcoholics Anonymous about 2 years after that. She came in on January 29th in 1990. I had nothing to do with it. You had everything to do with it because you had not treated her like she was too young when she came in the first time. You didn't treat her like she hadn't suffered enough. You didn't treat her like because she did drugs it somehow negated her alcoholism. My daughter got sober twice before it was ever legal for her to drink once. It was easier for her to get drugs than it was alcohol. But she is a real alcoholic. My daughter has 17 years of continuous sobriety, and that is an AA miracle. Almost half of her life has been spent in Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, when she was sober that first time, she started hanging out in slippery places with slippery people, and I was pretty sure she was going to drink, and what it felt like is, if she drinks, I'll die. For the umpteenth time I said it, for the first time I meant it. If you can't abide by the rules of this house, you cannot stay here. I planned the deadline day to be the day I was leaving to go to Crested Butte to be with Jeff and Brooke, because I didn't want to kick my daughter out. I love my daughter. Oh, I love my daughter. I wanted her healthy, happy, home, and whole, and she couldn't do any of those things. So that morning when I was kicking her out, packing my car, crying to leave to go to Crested Butte, she threw herself across my bed and she said, "You're going to be a grandmother." And I thought that changed things. I thought, now I'm going to have to stay home and take care of her. And it took a couple of hours of torture for her and me before I picked up the phone and I called my sponsor and I told her what was happening. And she said, "Do you want her to stay?" And I said, "I don't want her to stay. And I feel so bad about that. Shouldn't a mother want her daughter to stay?" She said, "No. No." She said, "There's only so many bad feelings in every relationship. These are hers. Let her have them." She said, "And if you don't want her to stay, I'll stay on the phone while you tell her." See, I thought the pain was in letting go of her. And what I realized was the pain was in holding on when it was time to let go. The pain is always in the resistance. And I quit hurting. But I went as quick as I could to Crested Butte to be with my 600 closest friends. And we went through a difficult fall. I went around telling people what she was doing to me now. Now she's pregnant at me. And she went around telling people what a mean mother I was, that she was pregnant and I wasn't going to let her live at home. I went to the Brazos Riverside Conference. My friend Buddy Ross was taping, and I said, "Buddy, she's pregnant at me." And I was serious as a stroke. And Buddy, sweet man that he was, he said, "Oh, Ellen, I understand that." He said, "But you know what? Our son's girlfriend had a baby out of wedlock, and that child has been the light of our lives. It never occurred to me I might like it." These old ideas not only darken my life, they will kill me, and they will kill the relationships in my life. Al-Anon has allowed me to change my mind, you know? I've loved babies my whole life, and until recently hadn't had my fill. And God was offering me a baby, and I was doing the yeah, but thing, you know? I think sometimes the sanity offered us in step two may be nothing short of paradise, but the reason I don't get paradise is because I say yeah, but. Yeah, but not this way, God. Not this child, God. Not this age. Not this time. Not me. Not her. I'm telling God how the universe ought to be run. The deal is, I know what's right, and you know what's right, and you know what's right. And I, by God, will stick to what's right. Thing is, God knows what's best. And if I can let go of what's right, you know, those are my old ideas, is what's right. If I can let go of that and let it unfold, what's best will happen for all of us. I decided to say, you know, my journey in Al-Anon has been the journey from yeah, but to thank you. Thank you. Thank you for my life exactly the way it is today. And I decided to say thank you for this baby. A couple of months later, she called. She said, "Mom, that blue blanket you're knitting, knit faster. I had a sonogram today. It's twin boys." Oh, yeah, yeah. You know those alcoholics, if one's good, let's have another, you know. So 4 days after she turned 19, this girl who didn't even like dolls when she was growing up gave birth to twin boys. And when they were 5 weeks old, she said, "Mom, I can't keep them, and you can have them if you want them." Well, you know, if you've never been loved by an Al-Anon, you don't know what you're missing. We love you at a cellular level. We love you from somewhere just below your feet to somewhere just above your head. And I had fallen in love with those babies' heartbeats in the hospital. And she said I could have them if I wanted them. Took a lot of writing, took a lot of talking to my sponsor, took tons and tons, hours and hours of praying. My sponsor had been telling me for years that God wants for me what I want for me in my heart of hearts, but I'm such an Al-Anon. I'm so afraid I might make the wrong decision. What if I decide something and the next week something else happens and I realize I could have had something better? But I'm stuck because I picked this other thing. Do you want to watch something painful? Watch a group of Al-Anons try to decide where to go for lunch. Oh, I don't care. Where do you want to go? Oh, I don't care. Where do you want to go? Thank God we have double winners who walk up and go, "Mexican food, we're going for Mexican food." And we all go, "Oh, good, Mexican food, just what I want." You know, and off we go. What my sponsor said to me was, "Sweetheart, God wants for you what what you want for you in your heart of hearts. Your job is walking in the direction of your dreams where you get as God's deal. And God's promise to you is this or something better. God's not a terrorist waiting around the corner to test your patience. God is not trying to hurt you. God's trying to help you. So, I went to adoption agencies, and I said, we're looking for a family that wants two babies and a grandmother. We thought it would take weeks. It would take weeks, and it took months. And they let me pick the day to surrender the babies because my daughter by then had moved out some months earlier, and it was me and the babies and my senior and high school son raising these twins. And they were not quite 5 months old. They let me pick the day to surrender them, and I picked the day I was leaving to Crested Butte to go be with 600 of my closest friends. Handing over those babies was the hardest thing I had ever done in my life. Every reason I had for keeping them was selfish, and every reason I had for giving them up was for them. And we did that. A year to the day after Melissa said, you're going to be a grandmother, we went to Lutheran services, and my son and my daughter and I handed our babies over to their new parents. They were 19 this last March. And up until last year, there had not been a month in their lives when they hadn't seen me. We had a meal together every month. I'm the grandma. I've always been their grandma. When they were a year and a half old, their parents called and said, guess what? Another girl has offered us. They're her baby, and this one doesn't have a grandmother. I not only didn't lose the boys, I got a granddaughter in the bargain, you know. God is good. God is good. And we've had a relationship with those people that I cannot describe to you. Ruby is older than I am. And it took the boys, they were about 10 years old, but they're boys. You know, boys are just like, well, they're like little men, don't you know? They're not clueless, they're just clue-free. Just totally clue-free. And they were 10 before they realized there was something weird about our family structure, you know. And their parents were waiting for them to ask the question, and they asked the question. And the boys and I went through a year of them saying to me, why didn't you keep me? Didn't you love me? Didn't you wish I could be your little boy? And when we got to the end of the year, we had an understanding. I was able to talk about it out loud with them and reach that place in me that I knew was the truth, and they knew it was the truth. And that was, I wanted you to have a grandma. I wanted there to be somebody special in your life who loved you no matter what, who didn't care what your room looked like or what your grades were or how sassy your mouth was or none of that stuff. And if I've told them one thing consistently through the years, it's been what I heard in Al-Anon, which is there's nothing you have to say or do or be or not be or do or not do to make how I feel about you change. I love you. I love you. And they know that. Now, they graduated from high school, and the last few years have been sort of hard on their parents, let's say. I believe they've aged incredibly in the last few years. The dad is now, whatever isn't gone, is totally white, and the mom is like into wigs because she can't deal with the hair. And Tony has done a number of nights in the local huskow because he keeps forgetting that the rules are for like everybody, you know. And Cameron got picked up just inside the Walmart with the newest addition to his illegal woman's underwear collection that he had at home. And the parents say stuff to me like, we don't know anybody else who has kids like these. And I'm like, you're not talking to your friends. Anyway, it's a remarkable relationship that I have with them. When the boys left, I did another inventory, and I discovered that ever since I was 12, I've either been chasing after, catching, going with, waiting for, engaged to, married to, divorced from, engaged to, married to, divorced from somebody. But there's always been somebody. I walk with this big empty hole beside me, and I just throw people in the hole to try to make me enough. I'd like to tell you how special they all are, but I don't remember most of their names. Anyway, this morning he was having us count, and I'm like, are you kidding me? I didn't number them either, but it was way more than three. Anyhow, I decided if I was ever going to know who I was, it would have to be by myself, that I could not be in any kind of relationship to somebody else. So I decided I had to quit dating. Apparently God and I decided the same day, because it isn't like I had to go to the front steps and go, sorry, boys, I've sworn off. There was no one there. Anyway, if you're not going to hang out with boys, God made it real easy. Made it really, you know, I didn't have to worry about hurting anybody's feelings. If you're not going to hang out with boys, it leaves you one other choice. Girls. Really. They are not my favorite. I mean, girls are okay. I'm a girl. Lots of you are girls. Al-Anon's full of girls. I'm just not a girly girl. I'm just not. You know, I shop like a man. If you don't know what you want, don't go in there, you know? And when you go in there and get it and get it out. Let's go. If you have something to say to me on the phone, say it. Hang up the phone. I am busy. Okay, now I'm going to figure out how to be with girls. So I'd call up the girls I'd sponsor, and I'd say, all right, girls, going to the conference this weekend in my big old Suburban, lots of room. Love for you to go with me if it takes you 12 pairs of shoes for one little three-day weekend. Okie dokie, bring all the shoes. Personally, I could do the whole thing in my Nikes, but you want to bring the shoes? Bring the shoes. Hannah, every time you have to pee, we'll stop the car. I mean, that is just bizarre. If you're riding along with a girl and they go, oh, look, there's a bathroom, do I have to? Yes, I do. Pull in, you know. Me, I could make it to Kansas, I'm pretty sure, all by myself. But. And I said, okay, and every time we pass a Walmart, we'll go in. That was the big concession. That's just torture for me in Walmart. Today I believe that there ought to be a red neon cross in the front of Walmart because I believe that healing happens in the wall, in the halls of Walmart. It happened to me. It happened to me over a $5 bathing suit in the Dumas, Texas Walmart on my way to Crested Butte with a car full of girls. I thought we were going to have to call for cleanup on aisle 12. I really did. We laughed over that $5 bathing suit. I could not believe that someone would actually, A, trust something like that they paid $5 for, you know, and get in the water with it. Are you kidding me? And it was like, whoo, the whole thing would dissolve or something. And the girls are daring me to buy the $5. And I had to buy the $5 bathing suit, you know. I always wanted God to speak to me in thunder and lightning because I don't know if you've noticed it or not, but drama is my life. And what I realize is that God, you know, God just rolls his eyes and he goes, oh, Ellen, if I did that one more time, you'd miss the message and you'd get lost in the messenger, you know. God speaks to me in the language I understand best, and apparently the language I understand best is another woman. After some length of time of not dating, it feels like, you know, like my 40 years in the desert. I'm pretty sure that's not what it was, but that's what it feels like. At some point in there, I got this wonderful gift. I discovered that I'm enough, that nobody has to be added to make me okay. I'm enough. That doesn't mean that I don't need help. It doesn't mean that I know how to do this, because I don't. What I discovered in all of that is how much I don't know, and that it's perfectly wonderful to not know, that there are plenty of women who are willing to listen to me, and there more than likely is another woman who's had the same experience I've had. They are my teachers. So about that time, this guy asked me out. And I had been sponsoring Alateens. We had a list. Single and sober was tied for first place since I apparently had a little problem with married men. and then there was solvent, spiritual, and sexy. It was all S's. And they said, you're looking for Superman. And I went, why, yes, I am. This boy was not Superman. He was not in the program. I'd known him for 10 years in the work life. He was just the funniest man alive as far as I was concerned. But of course, we're married now. We dated for like 4 years, and the deal was that if he was going to hang out with me, he had to hang out with you, because you're my people, you know. He had to hang out with you. He thought that alcoholics were about the funniest people he'd ever heard in his life. We were a little too emotional for him, but funny. 1994 was a hard year. By October, I was stone nuts, and my sponsor said, you're going to do a written first step, and so I sat down with her at a conference dinner, and she said, read to me what you're powerless over. What she meant was what you're furious at, and the first thing was his snoring, you know. I love him, but I wake up in the middle of the night thinking of the stories I'm going to tell God about what happened to him after I kill him dead. And the second thing I turned over was his drinking. He was not an abusive drunk. He didn't stay out late at night. He was always where he told me he was going to be when he said he was going to be there. The deal was, when he came home, I would open the door and I'd go, hello. And if I smelled alcohol, my night went to hell in a handbasket. I needed to know that other people could drink and I could be okay. An hour later, he walked up to the podium, said he was an alcoholic, took a chip, and he hasn't had a drink since then. Best thing I ever did for him was the best thing I did for my kid. Get a program, get a life, and get out of his way. and let him do what he needed to do. He spent the weekend with Steve just a couple of weekends ago, and you know what? He's been sober 14 years now, and it's not that long, 12 years now, and he is, you know, he still loves Alcoholics Anonymous, which I find pretty amazing. About that time, oh dear, oh, there's so much more story and no more time. Oh, so sorry. Goodbye. No. No, I do have to tell you one more little thing. At one point in there, my son and my daughter, my daughter got pregnant, my daughter-in-law got pregnant within a year of each other, and they both said, we want you to quit your job and stay home and take care of our babies. Now, these were the people who, the only people on the planet who'd ever seen me angry, and they had seen me rageful. I had pinned them to the wall with my anger, and they wanted me to stay home and take care of their babies. My husband said, no, oh, no, 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 we need the money you're making. You're going to have to stay home. You have to keep job working. Well, about that time, he heard a Clint H. set of tapes where somebody asked Clint exactly how much money would you have so you wouldn't feel financially insecure. And Clint said, well, I guess just enough money so I wouldn't have to trust God. Everybody makes that same noise when I say that. And Dick said, well, okay, you can come home. So I came home and opened a little business. Moms, Better Babies, Affordable Daycare for Your Priceless Children. But the only children I would keep are my grandchildren, so don't ask. Madison came to me in August of 97. Tristan was born in December of 97 and came to me in January. Kennedy was born in March of 99 and she came to me at the end of March. Sutton was born in October of 99. My children had four kids between them and they had them in 3 years and I had the best job any human ever had. The best job. You could go to work in your pajamas. They paid me to sleep with my clients, you know. It was great. At one point in there, it was 2001, so Tristan must have been almost three, and I got word that my sponsor of all those years was dying. She had 2 weeks to a month to live, and I had just gotten the phone call that morning, and I said, tell her I can't come today or tomorrow. I got the kids, but I'll be there Saturday. I'm coming Saturday. Apparently, I was a little brusque. I had to get them all in the car, and apparently, I was a little brusque jamming all the little kids in their car seats, and Tristan reached over, and he patted my arm, and he said, Mimi, breathe in, breathe out. It was my sponsor speaking out of this little kid, you know, and I knew that, number one, I wasn't losing her, and number two, that somehow she's passing it on through me to them. We take the little kids. I lost my job a couple of years ago because they all lived, and they got to be old enough to go to their neighborhood schools, and I got to experience empty nest, which was not what I had with either one of my own kids. I changed the locks on both of them. This time I got to feel that depression and that grief that comes from somebody who did you just love better than breath has left your home. Now, school's out. My babies are coming Tuesday, and we will spend the summer together. I get them for summers and vacations and sick days, and we always act like we're not excited when they're sick, but we're all very excited when they're sick. We take them with us every summer to Crested Butte to be with 600 of my closest friends. I cannot keep alcoholism from touching these precious, precious children. Chances are far better that it will touch them. But maybe, just maybe, what I can do is make AA and Al-Anon safe places for them so that when trouble comes, they'll know where to go. I used to think that when I died and went to heaven, God was going to say, pull out the VCR and the tape, and I want to know how her husband and her children turned out. And if they turned out to be fine, upstanding members of the community, she's earned her way into heaven and she can come in. I am so grateful that you let me find another God. Another God who continues to reveal himself, herself, and disclose himself, herself to me more on a regular basis. I tend to make up stories in my head and I live in my stories when I don't know what's going on out here. But this is a story my sponsor says I can have. I'm not sure what's going to happen when we leave here. What I think is when my body is tired of doing whatever it is we're doing here, and that part of me that's always been God's goes to wherever it is God's is, that when I get there, God's going to go, oh, Ellen, there you are. Why would God greet me with less love than you do? And God's going to say, you know what, precious? Heaven's heaven when you're not here, but it's just not perfect without you. And then he's going to say, you know what, I've been running a little experiment down there, nothing you could pass or fail, just a little experiment. And I know you've been paying close attention. I'd like to know how it's going. I know that God in my heaven is going to want my opinion. Yes, I do. The first question is going to be, did you have a good time? You know, there was nothing I did down there to torment you. Everything I did was to try to free you and make you happy and fill you with joy. Because of you, I'm going to be able to say, oh, yes, God, I had a great time at your party. Thanks for asking me. And the second thing he's going to say is, were you Ellen? You know, you were the only one like that I made. I had things for you to do that nobody else could do. I had things that I needed you to do because my hands are too big. I worried about that for a while because I've spent so much of my life trying to be what I thought other people wanted me to be that I wasn't sure if I'd ever been Ellen. I do a written inventory every night, and for a number of years I added a line to that written inventory, and it was, today, Ellen. And I wrote down that day what I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt was mine to do that day. This was mine to do today. You could have had another speaker and been done probably 10 minutes ago, but that's not what happened to you. 99% of what I wrote down is what you would have called service work. And the last question he's going to say is, baby, did you ever get the joke? You know, I got the joke the year of cancer. I got the joke the year of cancer, standing at my back door with no hair on my body. I won't go into deep description, but you know what I mean. All that was left was the gray, and it was like fried nerve endings that kind of blew around on the top of my head. So I wore a little hat so I wouldn't offend you with my nerve endings on my head. And I had a really weird-shaped body. I had a crazy hot pink neon orange daughter who lived over the edge of the planet someplace. I had a beige and navy blue son who was disappearing more and more every day, slept more and more during the day, was more and more awake at night, a husband who would say, what's for dinner, and not come home for 2 or 3 weeks. And I got ready to walk out the door one morning, and I looked down and realized I was going to have to go back and shave my legs. I'd lost all the hair on my body except under my arms and on my legs. And that was the day I got the joke. I lay on the floor and I laughed till I cried. I have spent so much of my life afraid of what I'm not going to get, that I think I have to be okay, or afraid that I'm going to lose what I think I need to keep to be okay, that I almost missed my life. I missed now. May you find him now. It's where God is in this instant. I almost missed that. There's a guy in our group that says the glass isn't half full or half empty, the glass is just too big. Which has to do with my expectations. Bill Cosby says the glass is either half full or half empty, depending on whether you're drinking or pouring. The magic of this is that by listening to me, you have added the magic. And when I sit down, what happens is I'm the one whose cup is going to overflow, and I thank you.